big love.
Yeah. Yeah.
Culturally, I think we ban time limits on grief.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think we literally ban it. Like, I think we say to the HR people in our organizations where we work, we're no longer going to say 6 weeks. It feels like it's been enough time. I think we ban all formulaic algorithms around time and grief.
Mm-hmm.
That's the big thing. The second thing is that I think we ban, I really want to ban, like a prop three on your voting thing, Tuesday, will be a ban on grief term limits. The other thing is that when someone's grieving and they come to us and they say they're in pain, I think we have to be okay with not being able to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
I think we can't take worth from knowing the right thing to say to make that grief lift.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause that's not our work. Our work is to be with people in the hard stuff.
Yeah.
So I think some empathy lessons would be helpful.
Yeah.
And then I think we make a move for all new empathy cards and no sympathy cards. Yeah. Like, yes. So cards that say, I feel with you, not for you. Yeah. Those would be my three strategies. I'll be running for grief president.
Okay, moving to the reckoning, the integration. Someone wrote in, I get the reckoning and the rumble, I think, but I don't seem to be good at making different choices moving forward. When we get to the revolution, I don't make different choices.
Me neither. Sometimes, like, again, there's that whole group of people I always think about when I think about the Sounds True Library. There's a whole group of people that, would say, the universe will continue to lay it in front of you until it changes your choices or... So the revolution is about integration. And the revolution is about holding your SFD. I like to call it the Delta. Holding your SFD up against the story that you would like to write. The story that I would like to write about the Des Moines event is, for a long time I thought that it was my job to let the people around me measure how well I was doing my work, how well I was parenting, and how well I was balancing the two. What I realized is that the only thing that matters is how me, Steve, Ellen, and Charlie feel about how our family is working. And the only person that really matters around my work is that I can wake up in the morning believing that I'm contributing more than I'm criticizing and that I'm working in my purpose. This is going to mean that I have got to get used to disappointing and letting down some people. And that is going to be hard for me. But the greatest joy in my life is really my family first and then my work. And I have to protect those things as fiercely as I can. So that's my new story, right? That's the story I'm going to write. I'm going to own the hard one so I can write this one. Then if I put my SFD up against this, what comes out of those is what we call key learnings. So if you compare my SFD, which is I'm not controlling my family enough, I'm not controlling Steve enough, I'm not controlling my kids enough, and Steve is trying to sabotage my career. And I look at the difference between those two things. What are the key learnings here? The key learnings are, number one, I need to make sure the behaviors I engage in clearly point to the fact that my work and my family are more important to me. Because right now, all my behaviors are pointing to the fact that what strangers think of me are more important. So that's the first key learning. The second key learning is controlling things is not working. Damn it. And I had a whole bunch of other key learnings, from that situation. And one of them was, I always think about like, oh my God, what is Ellen going to tell a therapist in 10 years? And then I realized, when I was doing this work, after this situation when I got back from Des Moines, that Ellen would probably say, my mom had this amazing career. She did this great work, but her guilt around it was suffocating for us.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I do not want that to be the story.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's really funny because this year for Mother's Day, Ellen wrote a card for me that said, I know it's not been easy, especially because your career has gotten so crazy, but I have to tell you how grateful I am to be able to watch what you have done, because you're in the stands at field hockey games when you can make it, and you're doing work that's changing the world, and one day I want to have a job that matters too, and I had you to watch, so thank you. It was the most amazing thing that I've ever received, but I don't think it would have ended up that way had I continued to try to control everything. I can't make it to everything.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do it all perfectly. So I can make the best choices I can make, and I'm going to miss some stuff, and I'm going to be doing some great stuff. So to me, that question about what happens is you got to compare that shitty first draft. And I can tell you the third, one third key learning is you will never have anyone who loves you and supports you more than Steve. Mm. Treat him like that.
Yeah.
You know? And so to me, the revolution is when you take those learnings and start trying to integrate them in your life. Like, okay, so what does it look like if you stop controlling? What does it look like if you do literally not put what people think of your family first, but your actual family first? Wow. Insight. That's what's revolutionary. And it was revolutionary for me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that experience led to the gifts of imperfection. Like I was like, I'm going to tackle this perfectionism thing like I do everything else. Like, I'm going to understand it and write about it. So I think that revolution is the integration of what you learn into your daily life.
Mm-hmm.
So like, as a leader, I'm the CEO of these companies now. We don't mind failure at all, as long as you can tell us what you learned and embed the learning in the culture, and we don't repeat it and we learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know where I got that? You'll think this is really crazy. You probably won't. All this work I do in Silicon Valley, the majority of companies there have failure on their performance evaluations. Not like, oh my God, you failed, but why haven't you failed at least once a quarter?
Yeah.
Like, the expectation is a failure a quarter. You just have to do it quickly, learn from it, embed, and move on.
Yeah.
Because if you're never failing,
yeah,
you're never trying anything new. And if you're trying anything new, that's trouble when you're in that sector.
Yeah.
And so it's really changed
mm-hmm.
my life.
Yeah.
I still don't like it, but it's worth it.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's one big topic I want to make sure we get to, because this is actually what we got the most questions from the audience about. And it has to do with rising strong with one's children, with parenting.
Yeah.
And, you know, in a nutshell, this person says, I so want a step-by-step on how not to talk to my kids in a shaming way. Please help.
Okay. Yeah, so what I can tell you is really invite y'all to check out Courage Works in the new parenting class. It's one of the favorite things I've ever done in my career. It is incredible. We even have, we've never done this before, we even have a prerequisite class that you have to take before you can take all the others, that's basically shame 101. And here's the thing about shame. We can't raise children who are more shame resilient than we are. So we can choose, you can choose not to shame your children, but what you really have to work on, and this is the bad, terrible news about parenting, I think, is the biggest call to courage around parenting is we just have to be the adult we want our children to grow up to be. You know, that's the hard news. The hard news is if we want to develop shame resilient children, children who believe in their inherent worthiness, then our job is to find a way to believe in our inherent worthiness. So what they see is parents who do not define themselves by what they make or what they produce, who can withstand failure and setback and disappointment without attacking themselves, who can talk openly about their vulnerability and their fears in an age-appropriate way with their kids. We just have to be the best version of who we want our kids to be. Here's the good news. Parents who screw that up and talk about the mistakes and make amends and apologize, their kids have much better outcomes than kids who perceive their parents never having made a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
So thank God for that.
That's a great,
right?
Yep.
I mean, that's really good news. But I can share one of the exercises with you that we do is we draw a house, cute house, and then we just make a list in terms of taking shame out of the house. What behaviors are okay here? What behaviors are not okay in our house? So like in our house, because we've been very aware of shame from the very beginning, no name calling, which means we don't call our kids names. We don't call each other names. And we don't allow siblings to call each other names. One of the most unspoken, dangerous areas around shame in kids is what parents let siblings do to each other. I can tell you some of the most heartbreaking interviews I've ever had as a researcher have been with adults who talk about completely disrupted relationships with siblings. Mm. Like they haven't spoke to them in years. They don't, you know, nothing. And every one of them in the deepest place, the question always becomes, I don't understand why our parents let us treat each other that way. Because siblings have access to all the information they need to really hurt siblings.
Mm.
They know about the tenderness of the acne or the weight issue, mm-hmm. or the date that didn't show up, or the special needs at school. And so I think creating a shame-free environment at home is really, here are some ways we're going to talk to each other, and here are some ways that we're not. And the number one question I always get is, oh shit, it's too late.
Hmm.
It is never too late. The most powerful letter I've received really in my career came from a woman. I write about it, I think, in Daring Greatly. A woman who said, my mom saw you speak at a church in West Texas. She wrote me a note and left it on my front door the day after you spoke that said, I did not know there was a difference between shame and guilt. I did not know there was a difference between you did something bad and you are bad. I think I shamed you your entire life. I meant to guilt you, which I thought was great. I thought it was beautiful. And the note said, because I always loved you. And even when I did not like the choices you made, I was so proud to be your mother. I hope you can forgive me for this. And she said, you will never know what that meant to me and my family because my mom is 75 and I'm 50. It's never too late. And parents always say like, okay, I'm learning all this and I'm trying to lace it in through like our dinner conversations. I'm like, no. Just say, hey, I went to see this lady talk. Some of the stuff she made sense. Some of the stuff I'm not so sure about. But here's one of the things I think we're going to start trying in here. We may be doing this. And with my kids, we use the Stormy first draft all the time. I say Stormy with my fifth grader and Shitty with my 12th grader. But we say Stormy first draft all the time. So if he'll come home and say, this is a great example, I'm the dumbest person in my math class. I'm like, whoa, that sounds hard. That sounds hurtful, Charlie. Let's talk about that for a minute. What does that mean? Everybody gets fractions but me. Everyone finishes the math minute in like 20 seconds, and I don't even finish the first row in the whole minute. That's hard. I said, can I help you check that out with your teacher? He's like, well, what does that mean? I'm like, can I talk to your teacher a little bit and get some more information? He's like, are you going to call her? And I'm like, I am. And he's like, do you have to say it's you? And I was like, yes. And he said, why do you want to call her? And I said, and you got to be careful here because you can't invalidate their fear and their concern. But at the same time, you need to dig into that SFD, you know? And so I said, because I want to understand more fully. It's hard for me when I hear you say, you're the least smart person, you're the dumbest person in your class. I don't think it's a good idea for any of us to talk to ourselves that way. And I want to help build a real story about what's going on with you so we can figure it out. He's like, okay. So I call the teacher. She's like, oh, my God, you're the sixth parent to call today. No one gets fractions. I told the kids we're not going to get them. I told them, yes, it's the math minute, but just do one problem. And the reason why everyone finishes before Charlie is they all try one problem. They're like, screw this. I'm just going to play now. And Charlie's just trying to figure it out for the whole minute. But no one's answering any questions on the math minute. So I'm able to go back to Charlie and say, let me tell you what I learned. He's like, what? And I said, talk to Ms. Sutton. It seems no one is finishing the math minute, but they're putting their pencils down in 20 seconds. They're not even trying. That's against the rules. And I was like, I know. I said, and he said, I try even when I almost want to start crying. And I was like, that too is against the rules. We do not do math in our family until we cry. I'm like, that is no. I said, I think you just give it a shot. And then at some point you just put your pencil down. He's like, and then just talk with the other kids. I'm like, yeah. That's what we're going to do. And he's like, and we're going to think about smartest, dumbest, think about that language. How else could we say that? He's like, I'm having a hard time with my math minutes. I'm like, that works.
Hmm.
Yeah. Because then we know how to fix that. We know how to address that. We know how to look into that.
Hmm.
And so those SFDs with kids, and let me tell you something, if the story they're making up, if what is a conflict is a fight between partners, a health issue in a family, the stories kids make up are really dangerous because just developmentally, they center themselves in the middle of it and say, Grandpa's sick, Mom could take better care of him if she didn't have to take me to school every day. Mom and Dad are getting a divorce. If I got better grades, that would be okay. Like, they really center themselves in stories in dangerous ways. So to be able to teach them the story that we're making up needs to be checked out.
Brené, I just have two final questions for you.
Two final questions.
In thinking of rising strong as a spiritual practice, the question that comes up for me, and I loved hearing you talk about prayer, very helpful and unusual as well, is I would love to know if you consider yourself someone who has faith, and if so, what is your faith?
Yes, I'm definitely a person of faith. Absolutely. There's a definition somewhere in my work of faith. I don't remember what it is, but it's like, I believe in the power of mystery. I believe in what I can't see. I think the thing that makes me the most faithful person in the whole world is I believe in people. And that is a leap of faith right now. I mean, that is faith. I do believe that people are inherently good. And I believe that people are inherently dangerous when they're in fear.
Mm-hmm.
But I believe in people.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, you mentioned how part of the reason, one of the three reasons you went back to church was to pass the peace. And I'm not familiar with that, but I noticed when I heard that, passing the peace, I thought, I wonder if Brené can share the essence of what's meaningful for you in that with us here as we close.
Yes. Let's pass the peace. Yeah.
So how do we do it? I have no idea.
How do we do it is,
and to all the people who are listening to this, how do they do it?
So I think, you know, in our tradition, in the Episcopal Church, the priest, he or she would say, peace be with you. And then we would say, and also with you. And then we would say, and let's offer each other peace. And so we would hug or shake hands and just say, like, peace be with you, or the Lord's peace, or peace of the Lord. And we would just wish whoever's around us in the pew peace.
And why is this so meaningful to you that it would be one of the three reasons you would go to church?
Because when I drive from my house to the grocery store, which is a mile and a half away from my house, it is likely that I will be flipped off two times in that. So we pass the bird like it's nothing. But we do. We flip each other off. We're hateful to each other. And so in this place where, I mean, like I kiss Steve and I kiss my kids, but then I like to pass the peace with strangers. Like I want to look in your face and say, dude, I don't know you, but the Lord's peace, I hope the Lord's peace is in you. Peace be with you. Like whatever you do this week, whatever you love, peace be with you. That's it. So I want to give that and I want to receive that. Because that's what my faith is in people.
Hmm.
So we should try it. Ready? I'm not a priest, but I don't know. This is probably against the rules too, but so peace be with you. Now I can do the whole routine now, but I won't. So let's offer the people around you peace.
Peace be with you.
Peace be with you.
Thank you for that.
That gave me goosebumps. Wasn't that nice? Peace be with y'all. Thank y'all. Tammy.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.